My name is Tommy T, and I'm an alcoholic. From the looks of the crowd, it looks like you got a little drinking problem down in the South, huh? A little bit. Before I get started on anything, there's some thank yous, and I'll probably mess up some names and things like this, but to our host, Brian, he was just wonderful. When I heard I was getting a local host, you know, a lot of stuff went through my head, all about hillbillies and things like that, and some of it was true, but we had a great ride over. It was 45 minutes from the Savannah Airport over here. We made the ride into the complex here, and then it was another 45 minutes to find the Westin, so we've affectionately called him GPS Brian. He just keeps going in circles, and that's good. To the previous chair, Jim, the current chair, Star, and the future guy, Jason, what wonderful people. You could not have made me and my wife feel more at home here, well-treated here. It's just been a pleasure. I actually feel bad about all the control jokes I've done about Star because, you know, events like this don't run this smooth without a lot of hard work and a lot of spiritual patience behind the scenes. So I hope I didn't test your spiritual patience too much with my comments. I am a loud, obnoxious New Yorker. But I've had just a wonderful time. And the thing about Alcoholics Anonymous that I find so amazing is that God just keeps surprising us, no matter how long or how short. Yeah, I don't care if you have 4 days or like my man Jack with 58 years. It just keeps getting better. So this, for me, my God's joke this weekend was, okay, Tom, you're speaking Sunday. Really? I'm a guy that doesn't feel I'm good enough, that I don't belong here, that I don't measure up. Sometimes I feel like a fraud in life and in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to listen to all these speakers, and the whole time I'm doing my talk in my head. Not an easy weekend. It was a good talk. I laughed, I cried. But now, unfortunately, you got me up here. My mind's all over the place, and I have no idea what's going to come out today. But there was something that give me a name. Last night, lovely woman, Marilyn. Jeez, there it's starting now. When she spoke of Clancy and the trouble she was in and the advice that sponsor gave her, and then she got in her car as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous and drove 5 hours because she knew God would give her the power, and she just happened to have a CD of Sandy Beach. There are no coincidences here. I have not had a coincidence in 27 and a half years here. But it made me think of all the men that God has put in my life and continues to put in my life that I would not be here without. So I hope at some point when we go down many rabbit holes during this talk, because what, I got 3 hours? Right. As Tom sees it, we are... I hope I get to mention those men that took and gave us the greatest gift that we can give here in Alcoholics Anonymous to our friends with 4 days, and even the old guy with 58 years who loves to talk, if you ever grab him, is our time and to listen. Because this room has been crafted by your pain and your suffering to be in a unique spot that you can help where no one else can. And when we start to do it, we're afraid, I can't do this, right? But our book has all our answers. You may be one man or woman with a book in your hand, but it contains all that you need to get started. And that's been my experience. You know, I heard like the Sunday guy is kind of like a spiritual speaker. And I said, well, that's a little hypocrisy there, but, you know, we'll go with it. But I looked up a couple of definitions of spirituality, and then there were some great ones. And one of them said that a deep-seated belief that everything and everyone is connected and driven by a force greater than themselves. And it went on to say that they enhance their lives by self-sacrifice and service to others. Boom. AA. Boom. Just a little Google thing. Right? We didn't have Google when I was coming up, but Google now. Right? Everything at our fingertips. So in order to try to focus this alcoholic mind a little bit and get some cohesion in some type of talk, I have no idea what's going to happen. I selected a prayer that I love, and I hope you don't mind, because I'm a little on edge. So this isn't for you, this is for me. But this is written by an overeating rabbi who practices our program to help him with his issues, and it's in The Sacred Art of Recovery. Rami Shapiro is his name. But it says, "My God, the soul you have placed in me is pure. I am free to live today differently than yesterday. Because it is pure, I am free to live without the burden of past habits, past fears, past mistakes, and past failures. I am free to look at my past without repeating it, to examine for it lessons to be learned and amends to be made, to draw from it what guidance I can to live differently today. My God, may I use your gift of freedom to further my capacity to serve you by serving your children with justice, compassion, and humility." It just sums up what we do, or what we try to do. And it wasn't always that way for me. My sober date is April 8th, 1995. I am the proud participating member of the Decker Avenue Step Group in Staten Island, New York. We meet on Monday nights. We're a small 12 and 12 group, and if you're ever in New York visiting us at 8 o'clock on Monday nights, you make a wrong turn out of Manhattan and you end up on Staten Island somehow. That's the only way you're going to find us. You come and see us, and I'm going to tell you, you will be greeted with a warm handshake, a real bad cup of coffee. But you're not going to leave there without a sponsor if you're suffering from alcoholism. And if you stay with us, you're going to go through these 12 steps. You're going to go through these traditions. You're going to get familiar with our concepts. And we're getting you in the service structure, whether you like it or not, because that's what we do. And we have a lot of long-time members because of that formula. It works. It really does. I've wanted to leave that group in 26 years that I'm a member there probably 52 times. But I come from a strong line of sponsorship that says, okay, let's do a little inventory. Let's look at why you're resentful. Just don't leave with the resentment. And then by the time I get to the fourth column in our inventory, I see it's just me, expected every newcomer to be different and everybody to share a different way and be a different way. And I'm like, okay, I'm back to home group. And it's been working pretty well. I did not come to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1995 willingly. I had a little help from the New York City Police Department, our court system, a lovely, lovely intensive outpatient program and rehabilitation program called Treatment Against Street Crime. I came in, I had a beeper back then for you older folks. And when my counselor beat me, I had 1 hour to go to give a urine sample. At the same time, an ex-wife of mine came out of the woodwork and wanted 8 years of back child support because I was a deadbeat dad when I got here too. I didn't live a good life, and I thought it was manageable until I met you guys and you spoiled all that for me. But I think it's a fair interpretation that you know the type of man that I was before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. At a young age, I felt totally disconnected from life. It felt like you guys all got a script and I just didn't get it. I wasn't in the room at that point. I felt my whole life that I was acting a role that I thought you wanted me to play. I never felt right. I hated the word normal. I hated my neighbors because they had a normal life. We were not the normal house on the block. My dad was a raging alcoholic. My mother, when I was listening to Catherine yesterday, was, why didn't Millie get this? Why didn't Millie have Al-Anon? She had a hard life, married to that man for 40 years. She even tried to join us for a few years there. That made my teen years just hell in that home. You never knew who was going to be on the floor naked, who got beat up. I saw things as a kid that you shouldn't see. I heard things that you shouldn't hear. I had to talk to cops more often than I needed to. I had to go to family day and rehabs all the time. I had experience with this before my 10th birthday. I didn't understand it, though. And I swore I'd never be like him. Never. Fast forward a few years, we both get arrested the same week for DWI, my second, his fourth. And we got to go to Alcoholics Awareness together. It's a class I could teach now. I have 4 diplomas from it. And one of the feature films was Not My Father's Son. I am sitting there watching this thing, and I'm like, oh, my God. And afterwards, my father was drunk at the class. I needed my license back, so I was a good little student. But he was bombed at the class. And he says to me, what a bunch of garbage that was. And I said, are you kidding me, Dad? That's our house. Oh, stop. You're exaggerating. Our man Clancy used to call it a disease of perception. My father didn't see it. He was doing the best he could with untreated alcoholism for all those years. And you know what you folks taught me with the fourth step? That he was right. I didn't stay. I ran out on a woman when she was 8 months pregnant because I was an untreated alcoholism. And I'm incredibly selfish and dishonest when I'm there. And I don't have the power to do it any other way. I'm afraid. 17 years old, I got one of my first girlfriends pregnant. We put a baby up for adoption. Her family was very religious, big family. There was no talking about terminating a pregnancy back then. And there was no way they were going to have her marry a guy like me. His name is Matthew. He's 45 years old. I've never met him. I'm on every website. If he ever looks, he can find me. I have a letter in my jewelry box and some pictures of him when I held him when he was a baby, because that's what my sponsor told me to do. And be willing, if he shows up at the door, that handsome Norwegian Viking-looking guy, probably looking for about 45 gifts and a whole bunch of memories, but terminated pregnancies, where I was man enough to pay for it, but I wasn't man enough to support the woman. If you were foolish enough to be a friend of mine, I stole from you. I lied to you. If you were really silly and fell in love with me, I was going to break your heart and probably your family's heart too, because I was going to rob from you and your family. And I didn't care. That's the scary part of this. You get to a place where you don't care. And how does an alcoholic like me deal with that? Well, I'll get twice as drunk on Father's Day, 3 times as drunk on Christmas, and I'll blame somebody. Because that's what I do. I'm a victim. Don't you see? If you had the father I had, you'd drink like I do too. Nonsense. You know, when I say my childhood was hard, I felt disconnected in a family of four. I mean, my sister used to tell me I was adopted, which kind of made me feel a little out there, but I didn't even feel right at that table of four for dinner. I hung on as tough as I could, but I was a liar and a cheat way before I picked up alcohol. I lied to try to make my father love me. I lied to cover up things I did to my mother. I stole from the house before I was drinking. I used to buy baseball cards with stolen money. Always something off. There was something off with me. But I held in there as long as I could until a couple of guys named Jimmy and Jimmy, yes, it was an Italian neighborhood, said, hey, Tommy, we're going to go get some beers. You in? I was 11. I'm in. You're going to need some money. No problem. Go rifle some coat pockets. Back then, it was a trusting world, you know. Get a couple of bucks. And Staten Island was a big, small town, you know. And you could write a letter and go to the thing. You buy cigarettes, beer, whatever you want. Sign it Millie. They all knew you, right? Butcher used to do the math on the bag and hand it to you. Tell your mother to pay me Friday, right? And we wrote this note, and we were going there. We're walking down the block, and we see this junkie, Glenn. Now, a lot of drug use and stuff was not out in the open then. They had the decency to go to the parks and hide, right? It wasn't out on the street. And this guy's catching one of these big nods, and, hey, where you guys going? Going to the store to get some beers. He says, buy them warm. Drink them through a straw. You'll get messed up quicker. Nice. Back then, we followed directions, right? You come to AA, and a guy with 25 years says, hey, son, do these 12 steps. Get a sponsor. Get a home group. You're like, nah, I got this. But that junkie on the corner, that's my life's coach right there. I'll follow him to the gates of hell, you know? And we did that. It was 1970. I had the cut-off dungaree jacket on. My favorite band, Yes, embroidered on the back, long hair, had my boombox. Here's one for some old folks. It was an 8-track player. And the big album that year was Neil Young, Harvest, and The Needle and the Damage Done. Oh, what a sad song for us to sing over and over and over at the top of our lungs as we drank our beers through our straws. Crazy. A wild thing happened that day. I drank mine down very quickly. I drank faster than my friends. They were putting the caps on their beer. It was Friday night. And they were hiding them in the weeds. We're the borough of parks, Staten Island. So we're always in the woods drinking. You know, we got drinking gloves when it gets cold and we light fires. That's what we do. And I said, what are you guys doing? They said, Tommy, tomorrow's Saturday night. We've got to have some for tomorrow night. I said, the hell you do? I push one guy down. I grab his beer. I start chugging it. I said, I'll get more money tomorrow. I made like a tactical error. I went after the small guy first. By the time I banged his half a quart down, now I'm sloppy drunk like the next 23 years of my life, basically. And I went after the bigger kid, and he threw me a beating. I woke up about 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, which was a problem. I had to be home at 10, all right? We had that street light thing going on. Street lights go on, you be on the porch. I'm not making any porch. I can't even find my porch at this point. And, you know, I had a cut lip. I had a cigarette burn. I didn't even smoked cigarettes at the time. And I did the thing that I've done my whole life. I started to play Alcoholic 20 Questions the next day. What happened? How'd I get my lip cut? Who burnt me with a cigarette? Did we have fun? And I couldn't wait to do it again. Caught a little beating from Dad, but no big deal. I was willing to accept that. I was willing to accept consequences for my drinking from the very first time. And you know, my grandmother, I don't want to get started on my grandmother, Jason, I will lose it up here bad. She said to me, Tom, you have to be careful about alcohol. All four of my sons cannot handle it. No tobacco male has ever handled alcohol successfully. It's like, don't worry about it, Grandma, I'm good. Warnings that I did not heed. It's in the big book. All four of my uncles and my father died of alcoholism and alcoholism-related deaths. And I still didn't think I was like them as I was coming up. But it was my answer to everything. It was my answer to everything. It relieved that tightness of chest that I always had my whole life. It just made it go away. And when I had that alcohol in my body, it was just okay to be Tom. I didn't care what you thought of me. I didn't have to impress you. I didn't have to do any of the things that I did every single day to act a certain way, be a certain way, be a tough guy, be this or that. I was just a sloppy, fun, rowdy, Staten Island hippie drunk. And I absolutely loved it. And, you know, I hear people from the podium saying, you know, my drinking wasn't fun. I had a lot of fun drinking. Right up until the point it wasn't fun anymore. See, because when I started, I drank to loosen up. I drank to have fun. At the end, I drank because I had to. I was disgusted with myself and the person that I had become. And it still gets me. The things that I've done in my life. But now it's my greatest asset. Because when that young man's talking, sitting on my deck, and he's sitting across me, and he's crying, and he doesn't think he's the worst guy, I can beat almost everybody's story. You know, they say, armed with the facts about yourself, you can win the confidence of a new man in a couple of hours. If I can't do it in 30 minutes, something's off. I need to go pray. I did some crazy stuff. We all do. It's not who I am. It's what I do when I'm sick. And I was pretty sick. So I'm not going to waste a lot of time with those stories because we're here to celebrate recovery. But I'll tell you, the worst 5 years of my drinking was 1990 to 1995 because I tried to control my drinking. I landed a good job in the Department of Education as an engineer, or my friend Joe from Cincinnati said, I boiled water. And I was in a very prestigious high school and a really sought-after job by many. And I went down to Jamaica to try to celebrate a little bit, you know, quiet little vacation. I went to a place, Hedonism. That didn't go well, but that's another story. But I came home, and now the beast was out of the cage. I hadn't been drinking for 3 years since a DWI in 87. Got that job, put my life together a little bit, and then I tear it down with a sense of useless sprees. Man, does that big book nail us or what? And so I'm working there, and the beast is alive in my head, and you can do this, you're making too much of this, you can control it, don't worry about it. And I would try it, and I would do 5 years of experiments to that, to firm up my first step. So, 30 years old, I'm not drinking in the clubs anymore. I'm the oldest guy in the club. It's pretty depressing at that point. So, where do you go? Go somewhere you can feel good, the neighborhood gin mill. Right? Sawdust on the floor, the old shuffleboard thing, still has 45s in its jukebox. A lot of people aren't going to get this. There's a lot of youngsters here. Smells like just beer and urine. You know, I mean, I love it. I love it. 365-year-old men in the place. And me in a tank top, because I'm in pretty good shape, you know. The Armory Inn, well, it was the Blue Manor at that point. And I would go in there, and I would have, they'd give you a short glass of beer with any shot you ordered, and I'd get my Jack Daniels and my beer, and I'd bang it down, and I'd bang it down, and, you know, I'd argue with the old men. They'd be talking about the Dodgers in the Polo Grounds. I don't know anything about that, but I'd argue with them about who won the game or the series, and if they argued, I'd beat them up. I beat up a 65-year-old man. I was a real, real proud guy at 30. And it was bad. But I'll tell you, if any woman would come into that bar, any young lady, I'm your guy. I'm your guy. Oh, you lost. Oh, let me help you. Oh, your husband's not a nice guy. I hate that. I hate men that don't treat women well. I had a little dive apartment down the street. There were some nice nights. I would be able to pull myself away from that bar stool, get myself a six-pack of beer to go, go down to that apartment, have a wonderful romantic evening with whatever her name was, wake up in the morning, and I would remember that name. My grandmother trained me well. I would take her to breakfast. I would open the car door. I would pay for breakfast. I would drive her home. She'd give me her number, and I'd take it and throw it out the window when she went in her home. And then my mind would start spinning. You can do this. You can do this. You go back up there Saturday night. You have that same, sit in the same stool, same three guys in the bar, same Jack Daniels. Same beer. No woman comes in. So now you close that place. And I go out looking for all the most sordid places on earth, Bill calls it. Right? And I'd find them. I'd find them. We're a pretty sordid island, if you look. And I'd just go out, and I'd go on a tear. I don't know what I did or what I said. I'd wake up, it's Tuesday. I got a cross-dressing dude in the bed next to me. Don't know how that happened. Some guys got my car because I used it for collateral. I don't know where I am. I look out the window, and I'm like, oh, I got to get home. I reach in my pocket, and I have some paper there. I said, this is great. I got some money. I take out 5 ATM slips. I wiped out the bank account. I can't even pay my rent. So that 5 years was, how bad was the debacle? That's how long I would stay sober. Totally mental obsession overtook me, and I had to go drink. So, you know, you beat up the old man. I felt pretty bad about that. It was a couple weeks until I did it again. Crack up the car. Everybody cracks up a car in my neighborhood. No big deal, a week. You know, waking up with Alex, 2 months. That was kind of bad. That was bad. Both times, that was bad. And then I went out for a couple of drinks and ended up in one of those binges, and I ended up getting locked up with my third DWI. But this time it had a little twist to it. I had a loaded handgun in the car, and I had some non-conference approved narcotics in the back seat, and it just didn't go well. It got real serious when they found the gun, and I was going to do a mandatory year because they had just passed out law in New York State. I was with a guy that I picked up in after hours. Swell guy. He's doing murder for life right now. There but for the grace of God goes die. Because when I'm on a four-day tear, I am out of my mind and I don't know what I'm doing. This guy continued to party after fear sobered me a bit. And he was breaking into his girlfriend's house during the day. And her 17-year-old daughter came home. And in a frenzy, he stabbed her 27 times. This is where I was, this is who I was hanging out with, this is what I was doing before I came to you folks in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did not come willingly. I kept kicking and screaming, I'm not sitting in a church basement with you losers. If you could have given me a six-step program to control my drinking, I would have been all in. I had no desire to stop drinking. I had desire to lose the consequences of my drinking. I could not imagine life without alcohol. That was a scary proposition for me. And on Staten Island in 1995, it was about making meetings. Meeting makers make it. And I love our fellowship. Don't ever take my talk because I mentioned about the steps to knock off fellowship. That's one-third of our triangle, and it's huge. And it kept me here until I heard a message of depth and weight. And I fought it, though. I fought it. I would come in at 2 minutes to eight. I would leave at 1 minute after nine, and I'd swear you were all a clique. Nobody's helping me, all right? I was so bad. Now, at this point, I'm 35 and a half years old. I'm in the gym because I think I'm going to jail, right? 5 days a week. I'm bulked up, not like you see me now. And I'd sit in the back because I'm too afraid to raise my hand and say, I'm Tom, I'm an alcoholic. If the old-timers, which they do, they would start in the back, I would get up and go to the bathroom or leave the meeting. If I drove past the meeting and didn't see somebody from my outpatient out front, I'd keep driving. How do you live in that type of fear and anxiety and still try to play it off that you're a man? It was impossible for me. It was impossible for me. But, you know, there was a bunch of guys in Alcoholics Anonymous who were great listeners. They might not have been the greatest sponsors. They might not have been your big talker at a conference, or they might. But these men would take me to a diner and listen to my newcomer nonsense for hours on end. And I mean, it was nonsense, all self-created chaos, right? And I always say, I met God in a diner. I didn't meet him in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to know God in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I met him in a diner with a bunch of old-timers that just had a gem for listening. And they told me that they were through things that I'm going through now. And I went to work every day waiting for this arrest to catch up, and then I would get fired because I was in, you know, the Department of Education for New York City. And I was just being quiet. I told a couple people what happened, but I didn't tell anybody. So every day, I'd go to work, wonder if the phone was going to ring, and I'd get fired. Then I'd go to the 4 o'clock lounge, which was they called it the House of Pain. Everybody just went to this meeting and dumped after work, you know? But that's where I started to go. But I started to be on the outskirts of our fellowship. Didn't have a sponsor or anything. But my first sponsor was kind of forced on me because they said, you got to have a sponsor. I had 10 months at this point. And his name was John, and he was a thermostat mechanic for the Department of Ed. I drank with him a couple times. So I said, I can have this guy. John said to me when he said, I got 7 years without drinking, but I don't know that I could offer you anything. But if you got a problem, call me. And I called him a lot. And he listened a lot. And he told me the slogans that he knew and everything. John never did any step work, any real work to grow here. The first lesson a sponsor taught me is John blew his brains out with 9 years of sobriety when I had about 2.5. He couldn't do it untreated. You can die here untreated of untreated alcoholism in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And John was a meeting maker. He could do two a day, three a day on Saturday. Everybody knew him in the fellowship. We were heartbroken when he shot himself. But there was things and demons in him that he couldn't handle without alcohol, and he wasn't handling it just with meetings anymore. So I'm taking advice from some of these old guys, and there's a promotion that's coming up at work. You know, if you stay clean for 18 months here, things are going to get better. Hopefully you don't get locked up for 18 months, so that's a plus, right? The court cases start to dwindle a little bit. The divorce becomes final. You might get your driver's license back. You know, that second year of sobriety, it's good. And but then I was putting in for a promotion. Because the old guys told me, no, we don't hide things here. We stand up for our past. You're going to be fine. Put it in God's hands. So I wrote all my arrests down on the application, and even the most recent one, and God fired me. So, you know. And if your recovery is anything like mine, I see everything in hindsight. you know, life comes at us pretty fast. It's pretty fast moving, and I don't see why I'm going through things when I go through them. But you give me 6 months and a good sponsor, I'll figure it out. I'll know exactly why I went through it. And you know what that first 18 months in AA was? It was about, if I get her, I'll be okay. If I just pay that bill off and that loan shark's not looking for me anymore, I'll be okay. If I work some more overtime, I'll be okay. It was all about the material. It was all about the external. I did nothing for my spirit. So God removed that. He removed the money from my life. I'm living on my mother's couch. I'm now 36. I'm sober a year, and I'm hating life. I'm hating life. And I go to a men's meeting, the Saturday Night Alive meeting. It was a meeting that about 30 men would sit in a circle. It started at 9, and everybody got a chance to share. You could be there past midnight. And the last guy would always say, I'll be brief. Well, I hate to tell you, that night, I was the last guy. I took that meeting hostage. I got fired from a 17-year career. I don't know what I'm going to do, this and that. No slack from the old-timers. None. Looking back on it, the only approach that would have worked with me. Tommy, there's 3 billion people in China. None of them know or care that you worked in the Department of Education. You'll be fine if you stay with us. But then my first step in my journey into recovery here in Alcoholics Anonymous was the 12th step of three old-timers on Staten Island. Keep it simple, Richard, a retired fireman. Lucky George, a bald-headed bookie from Brooklyn, covered in tats, chewing on a Tipperillo. We probably hung out with Joe, Meatball Joe over here. And a little guy, a little nerdy guy, business guy, Cocaine Vinny. That was the nickname. And they approached me after the meeting, and they say, hey, Tommy, we heard you lost your job, man. We'd like to hang out with you tomorrow. You know, make sure your first day is good. And God wants you on the golf course. Corny stuff. And I said, didn't you just hear what I shared? I have no money for golf. They said, we don't want to ask you for a financial statement. We asked you to play golf. We'll pick you up at 8 o'clock. We got clubs for you. Don't worry about it. And we played golf. What I found out later is these men had it all planned. They saw a struggling member of Alcoholics Anonymous ready to go out. And they circled those wagons, as we do here. And they did not let me stay alone for many of those first couple of days after losing that job. They convinced me to get a business card, and I'm really good with my hands, and started. I was doing construction in 2 days. I had a steady income because of these men pushing me. You got a truck? You got this? Come on, go earn. Go earn. No, you're not going back to the courts and getting your child support. You got to pay that money back. They were hard on me. Thank God. Thank God. We get on that golf course, and I don't know that Lucky George just went through a workshop on Staten Island. See, Staten Island might be a little crazy place, but we had 3 guys come in 96. Guy Don Pritz, Mark Houston, and Joe Hawk. And they started doing workshops and retreats at Mount Manresa, and the island transformed. Now people were working with other alcoholics out of the thing. My friend Charlie down in Texas, he says, yeah, it's great to see that the 12 steps are making a comeback in Alcoholics Anonymous. But that's exactly what happened. And my boy George was on fire. And they put me in the cart with George, and George gave me a pitch that I had not heard in 18 months here. He said, I'm worried about you, kid. I think you're going to drink. I said, George, I've thought long and hard these last few days on that, and I'm not going to drink. I know that's not my answer. You guys have taught me that. But I want to kill myself. I can't imagine it any longer. What's George say? Well, Tom, that's a mighty permanent solution to a temporary job problem. Like, no slack. Like nothing. I'm suicidal, man. Can't you, like, pat my head or something? I don't know what you're supposed to do. But he said, I guarantee you, you never have to feel this way again. But it's up to you. The actions you take in these upcoming weeks will determine the outcome of your life. Nobody ever said that to me. He said, we take responsibility for ourselves here. You too can recover from this disease. I said, wow. He said, are you willing to come to my house twice a week? He was retired. I was fired. He said, I'll cook dinner. We're going to read from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're going to do whatever that book tells you to do. I'm not going to tell you to do anything. I don't have a program of recovery. It's in the book. If you're willing to take the actions that that book lays out for you, I guarantee you, you never feel this way again. He said, I'll give you a little tape. You can reinforce what we read. But if you put the effort in here, your life is going to transform. You won't even know what's going on. Dead serious. I was broke. I heard free dinner. I'm in. He's from Brooklyn. He's got to be able to cook, you know. And what a great journey with George. That first step I couldn't get enough of. I got hope. We read that book, and my mouth must have fell open, and George said, what's the matter? I said, I can't believe they wrote this book about me in 1939. It was nailing me. And he transferred my name into the book. Does Tom do this? Does Tom do that? And he made it my book. And it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. I went through step two with a willingness to believe that George believed, and a firm knowledge that my life, based on my will, was not working. I said that prayer. We got up and wrote an inventory. And when he said, next we launch out on a course of vigorous action, I'm like, whoa, two steps a night? That's a little crazy here. The book says, it's a time reference. Next, let's go. He made that fourth step so easy for me by keeping me in the columns and just keeping me what I was doing. Didn't let me think about the fifth step or the ninth step or anything. Just kept me current. 9 days, 96 names, a bunch of resentments. I had 31 resentments for that alcoholic father, 29 resentments for my mom, who only loved one man. How'd I do, Chef? All right. She told me to change something I just said, and I just did it right, so I want credit. I need a parade later, so I usually make a sex reference with my mother. It doesn't sound right. So I just killed it. No. But the miracle of that fourth step is before I shared that with my sponsor, I lost those 31 resentments for my father because I saw he was a better father than I was capable of being. I saw my mother had no way out. I looked at them differently after writing that inventory. My fear inventory, I am afraid of everybody and everything. And I'm too proud to tell you about it. I had a fear of salespeople. Can I help you, sir? No, thanks. Just looking, you know. Bad shape at 36, I'm telling you. And then I wrote that relationship or sex inventory, they call it. And I saw I was in this same relationship for 23 years with 23 different women. I'm real good at making a girl love me. I just don't know what to do with it afterwards, and I'm not man enough to have a discussion to say that I'm not in love with you. So I'll take whatever I can get. And then I just have deplorable behavior to force you to break up with me. That was a little tough to stomach. But hopefully it set the groundwork for a new life in that area. I shared my fifth step with George, and I lied to him, because that's where I was at. We went to Mount Marissa, a wonderful retreat place, and 75 stairs up a mountain. We decided to do it up there. And I read everything except for the things I've told you. I mean, I stole money from a grandmother who loved me to death when she was dying of cancer and just had a leg amputated, and I lied to her. That I'm a deadbeat dad. That all the things that I did, I wasn't telling George that. So I went up there, I took a couple pages out of my book, put it in the car. Went up and told George my story. He said, man, this is great. I'm having a blast taking you through these 12 steps. You're doing such good work, Tom. He says, but I want to tell you, we're only as sick as our secrets here. Oh, no, he knows. So if there's anything you left out when you're getting quiet with God for an hour, please give me a call. Let me know. No, that's it, George. I'm walking down the stairs. George doesn't come down. I'm feeling like his eyes are piercing the back of my head. I got that angel and the devil. Tell him, don't tell him, tell him, don't tell him. I mean, it's still going, right? Nothing's recovering here. And I go in my car and I sit down. And those of you who have had these experiences, you know they are real. I felt a warmth come out from under that seat, from those pages that were there, that just made me take a breath without hesitation, pull those pages out, open my car door and say, hey, George, wait up. George never came off the mountain. He stood there. Come on up, kid. Let's finish this thing.
Okay. You know,
it felt like an eternity walking back up those stairs. But I laid out my 10 worst things that I've done in my life, and they're pretty bad. And he gave me a big hug. He didn't care. One man knew everything about me, and he was still telling me, tomorrow night, 6 and 7, I'm cooking pasta. I'll be there, brother. It was awesome. Miracle of that fifth step is I went home that night and I put my head on my pillow. I went to sleep. There was no tossing and turning. There was no voices in my head. There was no chatter of 1,000 monkeys that I dealt with my whole life. It was quiet. I only slept about 5 or 6 hours, but I woke up refreshed, like you noticed it. I was getting a little nervous. Like it was like, what's going on? Well, the nervousness, we did 6 and 7. I don't think anybody understands 6 and 7. Said another prayer. But I started to pray that prayer and pray that prayer and pray that prayer. George got me into 8 and 9. We made a list. I got paralyzed in fears and I balked. In less than 10 days, the thoughts of suicide were back. Because now I had opened Pandora's box. See, we don't tell the newcomer that. Like, if you're going to start, you better finish. Because now you're going to know a whole bunch of stuff about yourself, and you better do something with that. But I didn't. And the fellowship stepped in. I'm standing in front of that same meeting, the Randall Manor meeting on Staten Island, hanging out with a few of my road dogs, smoking Marlboros one after the other, looking at the newcomer girls as we did. And all of a sudden, the guy, Bobby, had about 30 years, postman, he comes up and he says, hey, Tommy, I heard you're doing the steps with George. I said, yes, I am. Chest pops out a little bit. Haven't told him I've been ducking George for 10 days. But he says, oh, could you come down and speak at St. Mark's Step Saturday? I said, yeah, I'm good AA. I'll speak on the steps. He said, well, we're doing step 9. Well, Bobby, maybe another time because, you know, I have a list, but I haven't made him. He just pats me on the back. He says, go make a few amends. Let us know how they turn out. Walks away. Now all my friends are like, oh, and we'll be there to watch, you know. So I told you about that fear of being judged and not being good enough. That actually drove me to go make amends. And I made amends to my mom. What a great place to start. Moms are wonderful. We both cried. And I was well trained back then. I said, Mom, is there anything? These are the homes I'm clear on. And I poured my heart out. I was a big thief, stole a lot of money, hot jewelry, pushed my mother down one time in anger. Did a lot of bad things. And I said, these are the homes I'm clear on. Is there anything that you'd like to tell me about I haven't mentioned? And she said, oh, yeah. You've left out a bunch. I started praying the 7-step prayer. She started crying. And she said, Tommy, I am so sorry that I never had the courage to leave your father and give you a better life. 29 resentments, boom. She said, I knew it was hard here for you. And I knew you were stealing all that money, but I thought if it got you out of the house, even for a few hours, it was worth every penny. Because I know this wasn't a good place to grow up. She said, but this last year and a half, I've been living my life through you, and I am so proud of you. And what that AA thing is doing for you. Moms are cool. I miss my mom. I went to my dad. He was in the bar. I couldn't get a lucid moment. Very uneventful. After the amends, he said, don't you have to go make it coffee for those assholes? Yeah, Dad, I love you too. Made amends to my sister. And then I had a letter to my grandmother. I hadn't been to the grave because I didn't see where she was buried because I was too ashamed to go. And I won't get into that one because I will lose it and that will kill the hour. But I was able to read that letter. And something happened that day. And in hindsight, I look at that day where the book tells us that my outlook on life changed. I went on a tear making amends. I thought God was with me all the time. Corny George, when I got scared about an amends, bring God with you. Pull up a chair for him. He would say, open the car door, let God in. I mean, he'd say all this corny stuff to me. And I'm going through them, and I'm nailing them. I mean, people on Staten Island were like, Tarako's making amends, hide. You know, like, I'm hitting everybody in every meeting. You know how it goes. Like, you know, and I'm telling the guys that listen to me for all that time in the diner, you're doing it wrong. You know, I'm like evangelical at this stage. It's just wonderful. I know AA. You don't know AA. I know you got 40 years, but keep coming. So, George out of the clear blue says to me, Tommy, don't you owe the Department of Education an amends? Stop me in my tracks. And I said, yeah, I do, George. I would like to see my court case finish before I have to do that. Corny George, why, would you like to try to manipulate the outcome, Tom, and fail as you always have? Would you like to put it in God's hands and see what he's got planned for you? Okay, George. So I put on the one suit we have when we're new. I go sit in this CEO of the Division of School Facilities, Jim Lonergan's office at 7 o'clock. I don't know that the boss is coming at 10. I spent 3 hours in my head looking like, oh my God, there's the plate glass window he's going to throw me through. You know, I'm thinking all the worst. I love that line in the big book. 9 out of 10, the unexpected will happen. 10 out of 10. I never know how an amends is going to come out. And I didn't expect this one. So Jim walks in, and I said, Jim, Tom Tarako, can I talk to you for a second? He said, Tommy, how are you? I said, I'm doing well. I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sober a while now. And he said, I heard you were doing good. Come in. I got your file in my office. 80,000 people employed in the Department of Education. Why you got my, I'm the worst you got? Like, this is what's going through my mind. And he said, sit down. What do you got to say? I said, well, Jim, coming up on 2 years sober, and I'm working 12 steps. And I want to tell you, 6 months ago when I came in to explain that arrest, I lied to you about everything but my name. Jim was a big guy, bigger than me. Put his glasses down. He said, well, that's interesting. He says, and what's the truth? I said, the truth is I haven't been a very good employee. I said, they were my drugs. That was my gun. I was driving drunk for the third time. But unfortunately, it goes a lot worse than that. I've stolen from the New York City schools. I've stolen time. I've punched other employees in and out. I've had parties in the boiler room when I was supposed to be working. I've just taken supplies, everything that I could from the department. And he says, that's interesting. He said, do you know I was a deacon? No Google, 1997. I don't know what a deacon is. He said, yeah, I do service in a church. I said, okay, I got an idea, but I still don't know. He said, so I know what it takes to come in and say something like this. He says, we don't find God because things are good. He said, mine was alcohol too, but I went to the Catholic Church. I haven't drank in 6 years. Wow. He says, he seems AA is working fine for you. I said, well, Jimmy, if there's any way I can ever make this right, I will. And he said, and I know you will if you keep doing what you're doing. He said, so if you do get your job back, I'm not the determining factor here, but if you do get your job back, you come back and see me. I know exactly what I want you to do. I said, okay, I'll do that. I walked out of there on fire. I couldn't believe the coincidence that he was sober. A case that was terribly stalled in the bureaucracy, which is New York City, all of a sudden I got a letter to appear for my arbitration case. It wasn't a formal court proceeding. It was about a job. It wasn't about legal stuff at this point. And I go before a board, and these attorneys pound me on the stand for 2 hours. Now, the thing was, I brought my AA file, right? I had a couple sponsees letters in there, my sponsor letter, my anniversary came. I had a 2-year coin in my pocket. George told me, rub a hole in that bad boy when you get nervous. And I sat up on that stand. I took a pounding. But I gave honest answers. Well, no, I don't recall those events. I was in a blackout. No, that's what happens when I drink. Well, I haven't drank in 2 years, this and that. And they go through the whole thing. And the last question was, Mr. Tarako, are you telling us that you have not ingested any drugs or alcohol in the last 2 years? And this, my sponsor gave me, I'm not sharp enough for this. He said, you show them that coin and you tell them how proud you are to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said to them, I'd like to thank this board for listening to me. You've already taken my job, but there's two things that you're not going to get from me today. And I showed my 2-year coin. They said, what's that? I said, it's my 2-year chip from Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been sober continuously for 2 years. With that, the arbitrator gives me a wink. To this day, I don't know if he was gay or that he was one of us, but it seemed to work out. Either way, I'm in, right? And then I said, and you can't take my integrity. I'm done giving that away, and Alcoholics Anonymous has given that back to me. And that's what my sponsor told me to say. 5 minutes in arbitration, they come back out. All we're asking for is the union job back so I could be reinstated. Not the promotion, not any of that stuff. They come back and they said, we are thoroughly impressed with your testimony today and how honest and how you held up to our courts. Now, for us here, if you're not going away for a long bid, it's no big deal. Like, what's my job? I'm already working. What do you want? But I answered them honestly. And they said, but we're more impressed with your willingness to help young men and the letters that they wrote and that you have a sponsor, and we hope that you continue to do that. You've done everything we've asked you to do here, so we're going to award you $17,000 in back pay. Yeah. We're going to give you that promotion if you can stay clean for another year and get in no trouble. And you're going to go back and be reinstated in your full job. We weren't asking for any of that. Do you guys know anybody who got paid 17 grand to go through the 9 steps? Come on. I'm that guy. So I went back to Jim, and he said, I heard you got your job back. And I said, I did. And he said, well, I know exactly. I've been waiting for this, and I'm happy. He said, I want you to always remember that you work for God, not the Department of Education. I want you to arrive early. I want you to work through your lunch hour if you have to. I want you to mentor young men on the job in engineering. I want you to be the most helpful employee. Don't ever become a union employee. You be management. You come up and work with me. Okay. A little much for me all at once, but that led a lifelong mentorship and friendship with Jim. Jim retired about 10 years ago or so, and they moved me into his slot after a bunch of promotions over the years, because that's what happens here. And I've just been grateful even for the worst day of work ever since that. 27 years, I'm in a retirement consultation now. They're going to have to pay me the rest of my life. It's just amazing. Like, it's just amazing. Like, I can't say it without laughing. Like, it's just such amazing. If we listen to those that were here before us, if we do the suggestions that were given here, and I do want to get one other guy in for this talk. George wasn't writing nightly inventory, and he refused to make some amends, and we talked about it at that time, because now we're two guys going on this journey. George was new in it and all. But I saw a transformation happen in this guy called Angry Joe. He was a biker. He had 17 years sober. He was sharing in meetings that he was going to kill himself. Had a big beard, didn't bathe as much as he should have, always used to... Angry guy, Chaps, the Harley Davidson thing and all. And I watched this guy transform while I was going through the steps. Short red hair parted on the side, wire glasses, and he's sharing about being a Montessori kindergarten teacher. He's studying, he's going back to school. I'm like, wow, I'm having an experience over here, but that's crazy. And George suggested that I find another sponsor, somebody who practiced 10, 11, and 12. And Joe was sharing a lot about 11-step inventory, and I asked him to be my sponsor. Joe was my sponsor for the next 24 years. He heard many of my inventories. When I started to date Cheryl in Alcoholics Anonymous, which I swore I would never do again, he said to me, you don't put your hands on her until you tell me face to face that you'll take full responsibility for her children. You've hurt too many women in your life. Now, Joe was a very quiet spoken man. When he said that, it stung. I said, I'll do that, Joe. Cheryl and I became best friends way before we ever had any physical contact. She told me things that she still regrets telling me as a friend. But we had the most wonderful courtship that I would have never experienced. I love you. We're together 17 years. We both married twice before. We laugh at every anniversary. Like, you couldn't add them all up.
We're beating them all, you know. It's just too funny. And somehow it works. Somehow it works, and it's because of Joe.
Joe got diagnosed with congestive heart failure a few years back, right around COVID. And Joe taught me, even in death, to be a man of integrity and grace here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Every night, every Tuesday night at 9:30, I would share my 11-step inventory with Joe. It seemed a little ridiculous when a guy's dying and I'm talking about Cheryl used the wrong term, tone to greet me at the door, you know. But Joe said, unless you fire me, I want to hear your inventory. A half hour I'm listening to your stuff is a half hour I'm not thinking about mine. We did a thing with Joe. Joe sponsored 13 men, and we were on Zoom at that point. So we said, what a great deal would be to get the sponsees together. And we'd had a Saturday morning meeting with our sponsor. We found out later from his wife, she used to have to prop him up, but he would not miss that meeting. We watched him dissipate very quickly on that meeting. And I don't know what spurred me to have the idea. I said, but wouldn't it be great if we brought all our sponsees on? Every guy Joe works with guys. 85 men got on the last meeting Joe ever attended and thanked him. There was two guys in the upper right-hand corner, and they both had the same last name, Green. The boy, the younger guy, shared, he said, Joe, I want to thank you for through all this. We just completed a vision for you, he told the group. Joe was reading with him up until the week he died. But then the old guy, Jack, shared. He says, Joe, you don't know me. I'm 51 years sober. I sponsor your sponsor. I know all about you. He said, but I made sure I came on today because I wanted to thank you for saving my son's life, the boy below. Where do you get that? Where do you get that? I was devastated losing that man, more so than when I lost both parents in 30 days in 2007, more so than losing my grandmother. No man on this earth knew me like Joe knew me. Joe told me, you got to promise me you have a sponsor within 30 days from when I pass. I said, oh, come on, Joe, let's not talk about that. Promise me. Okay. Send a text to all your guys and put me on it. I'm not always honest, what can I tell you? So I did that. And Joe passed. I was really sad. My wife's a realtor, and she was doing good that year, and she bought me this really nice watch for Christmas to try to cheer me up, my birthday. And I was choked up about it. It's a watch I've always wanted. I wanted to get it when I retired. Didn't have the money to get it. Cheryl made that happen. And then she said, look at the inscription. And it said, WWJD. Now, my Christian friends here would say, what would Jesus do? For me, it's what would Joe do? And it's the same thing. It's the same thing. So, it's my hope. As we move forward after this talk and in our lives, I really want the rest of my life to be the best of my life. So I will continue to do all those things that Joe taught me to do. Because I know my grandmother, your grandmother, Joe, and all those people that were here before us that took the time to listen to us and try to mentor us, they're watching us. I always want to talk like I know Joe's talking. I want to be the husband that Joe wanted me to be. I want to be the father. So four children now. That son I abandoned came and lived with us. He's clean with us in AA 8 years. He got more than just good looks from his father. What a life. What a life we're given here. I always want to show up at my home group a half hour early. I'll kid with the guys. I'll flirt with the girls, although I'm kind of like a daddy figure now. It's not really a good role for me, but I still think I got a shot, you know. So as long as the delusion is there, I'm all right. But I'm telling you, in all seriousness, my eyes are trained on that door because I know who's new, who comes to our home group that's new. And I will always be beeline right over to that person, make sure they got a big book and a half a cup of coffee, and I'll tell them where the bathrooms is. And I'll take their number as well as give them mine, because I know how hard it was to make that first phone call in Alcoholics Anonymous. I won't stalk them, but I will text them the next day, how you doing? Give me a call if you need to talk. They're dying out there. If Staten Island, if Hilton Head is anything like Staten Island, it's not a relapse where you come back with another DWI or you do a little jail time or maybe you lose the wife. They're dying. They go out, they don't come back. I'm tired of going to wakes. Get off the phone in the meeting. Do what you... I'm that surly old guy in the home group now. What are you doing? Put that away. Oh, you got to see the looks I give my guys. Sorry. You know, look... I aspire to be Clancy now. I used to hate the old guy. I aspire to be him now. Because I'd rather step on your toes here in AA than dance on your grave. It's that serious. Don't ever lose sight of that. Let's leave here today and take a little bit of God with us. Take a lot of AA with us and just help that next person that still suffers from alcoholism. Because we can help them where other people can't. Don't ever forget that. God bless all of you. Thanks for having us. I'm Tommy Tate.